Good evening. It feels so good to be back. I got back Saturday night after a long trip. It took all day. Everyone sends their best from Hokkoji. Like we're all part of this whole big family, even though we're all spread out there in the desert. And we're in this very different place. Gosh, it's so different out there. You would all love it if you haven't been there. Julian knows. It's really...
I'll be there one day.
Yeah. There's so much space. The land is so spacious. And then the sky over it, with always something going on in the sky. Huge white clouds kind of drifting around in the morning. And then in the afternoon they start piling up and turning dark gray and starting to grumble. And there's lightning and thunder and everything comes crashing down. And then it all, they're bright stars at night. And you've never seen so many stars. It's incredible. Because there's not much ambient light, like unlike here, where we can hardly see anything in the sky anymore. And it's utterly, utterly quiet, because it's way up on the mountain, and you just don't hear anything. Coyotes at night, sometimes. A neighbor's dog barking. That's it. It was a very poignant session again. Last time I was there in April, the man who lived there with his wife suddenly became very ill. He knew he was sick. He knew he had cancer, but he thought he had many months still to go. And suddenly he obviously didn't have hardly even a week. And he wanted a precept ceremony, so I had prepared everything for his precept ceremony, and we had a rakusu made for him, and he just barely could sit up to receive the precepts and take the rakusu. And 2 days after I left, he was gone. This time, Lori, who has sat with us out here, who had sort of more or less conquered leukemia last year, came down with it again. And by the time it was time for me to go out there, I'd been talking with her on the telephone, and I told her on Monday that I would be there on Friday, and she said, "Oh, I don't think I'll make it." So when we were chanting the Heart Sutra and dedicating it to her, she had about an hour left. She just slipped away very, very peacefully. Her parents and her brother and her son were there, and she'd taken care of, she was a very bossy woman. She'd been in a wheelchair for 40 years and completely ran her life with a lot of pizzazz. And she bossed everybody around. She canceled her credit cards and took care of her bank account and just did all, you know, on her deathbed, and was bossing everybody around how to take care of the house and how to feed the cat and all those things. And then they asked her a question at a certain point, and she started thinking about answering it, and then she said, "No, I'm just too tired," and she turned away. And they said after that she just let them take care of the rest of it. But slipped away very, very easily. So when I got there on Friday, they had had a vigil. They had her in her living room lying on a kind of bier with flowers all around, her empty wheelchair. Her beautiful little house, little adobe house that she had at Taos. And they had left. We missed the vigil. They had already packed her up and taken her to Albuquerque for cremation. So I missed that part of it, but I had a chance to be in her house for about an hour, just to be there with all of it. So that was how the sesshin began. So it was very poignant. And when we ended it, we decided that we should have a memorial service. And so we, Ian, who was the teacher out there, maybe you've sat with him at Jikoji, very wonderful guy. He and I put together a little service in which we had everybody recite the five remembrances. The five remembrances that human life is bound to get ill. Human life is bound to come to an end. Human life, we lose everything. We can hold on to nothing. I can't remember the other two. But it was a kind of divesting oneself of all of our certainties and accepting that life is like this. It ends for everyone. Sometimes when somebody dies, we think, oh, that's so sad, but not me. No, I won't go there. It's so hard to think of, actually. Actually slipping away like that. I found a thing that Koban said about the end of the Heart Sutra, the Gate Gate. And usually he would say it means falling apart, always falling apart. But one time he said it means let go, let him go, let her go. Let me go. Let everything go. It's our practice. So it was nice to come back and use our words and our way of doing the Heart Sutra. Every place I go, it's a tiny bit different. They do use the Mukugyo to chant the Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara, like that. So it's a different kind of feeling. And they have few different words in the echoes that aren't familiar, and I always stumble over them. All Buddha's 10 directions, all venerable ones, bodhisattva, mahasattvas, venerable ones. That's all new to me, so it's always interesting trying to figure out what's going on. So I didn't bring anything tonight. I felt kind of naked because I didn't have any books or papers to bring. Because we're done, or at least we're mostly done with the precepts. So I think our job is to agree on what we're going to do next, if we can do that. And before we do, I want to hear introductions around, because
Brent, me too.
Dan,
I'm
in one.
Bruce.
Julia.
Francois.
Angie. So you were in the Wednesday group, weren't you?
No,
not in the Wednesday group. Someone who looks something like, a little bit like you. How did you hear from us, about us?
Website.
Good old website.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And you? Ah, nice. Welcome to you both. So we've been spending many, many weeks studying the precepts. We're never done with them. But we go on to some new thing for a while before we come back to them again. My files are this thick with the precepts now, with all the material that keeps accumulating. But better to let them go. Just let it all go and let it live us, because that's what it is. It's not some kind of thing we're pasting onto ourself to try to be good. It's how we live and stay awake to how our life is going. Just being awake. So, are there suggestions? There's lots of material out there, tons and tons of it. There's lots of Dogen, including the first thing that he talk that he gave that was to lay people, Bendoa. And then there's the Genjo Koan, which is probably his most famous piece, which is very wonderful. And there's the Platform Sutra. Are we going to do the Platform Sutra in the small group?
That was one of the definitely. One of
that
the
was a suggestion. There. Yeah. So there's that, and there's the Heart Sutra. Red Pine has written a wonderful book about the Heart Sutra, as well as the Platform Sutra.
And there's also the Diamond.
And the Diamond Sutra. Yes. It's a big book. It's huge. It's wonderful. Very rich. So, and there may be other things that you all have thought about, know about. You must, Dan.
Yeah, I remember the last time we did something with it's like poetry. I think we talked about. I mean, we've done. I think we have done stuff like that. Didn't we? What's the one? The Sandokai. You know, the one Hiroshi wrote his one of the commentaries on. You know, things like that.
Yeah, we could do Sandokai.
Interesting about, you know, there are a number of people in the group that are, you know, English and poetry oriented, so that might be enjoyable for that reason as well.
Yeah, it's real Dharma, though. It's it's a wonderful sort of opening up of the dark and the light together and how they work together. Yeah, so there's the Sandokai. We did that in the small group, but it would be great to do it again.
What is the name of the piece, Merging of Relative and the Absolute?
Yes, that's Sandokai.
That's Sandokai?
Yeah.
Wow. What am I thinking of?
The Mirror Sutra?
What's the one? Is that the one where the first few lines say something... just avoid picking and choosing?
That no, that's the third patriarch.
Yes, yes, thank you.
That's right. We did that.
You did do that?
A long time ago.
Okay. Better memory than me.
Yeah, we can do it again.
Yeah.
It's good. The great way is without difficulty, just avoid picking and choosing. So. Well, it would be nice to decide tonight so that we could gird ourselves with whatever the material is. If anybody wants to... Wendy?
It's been a really long time since we studied the Heart Sutra, and we do have a lot of people, newer people, that might appreciate that.
It's true. It's true. And that's a sort of, yeah, we chant it every single, yeah, not only every single Tuesday night, but in every single occasion. Birthdays and death days and weddings and everything in between, always the Heart Sutra comes up. So, what do you think, Francois?
I was going to say Heart Sutra for that exact reason.
So okay.
I say it every time and I don't fully know it. So.
Yeah, what does it mean? Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form.
I presume exactly what it says.
Yes. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. It's very rich. Very rich.
How long does that process take?
Of?
The Heart Sutra that goes through that.
Well, it's about 28 lines or so.
It's
so.
It's going to be like a worst line of Dogen. Is it that like 7 or 8 months?
Poor Russ. He suffered with that.
It's not that hard, Russ.
Oh, you're right. It did go on a little long. It won't be as long as the Dogen for sure.
Dogen next.
I think you divided it into like 4 stanzas each time.
Yes, something like that.
Like that would be 7.
Yeah. Yeah. There's Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra, so it's well to know who those are. And then what form and emptiness is talking about and what the 5 skandhas are. Oh, I know it. Pretty well. And the 5 skandhas are really important. Each one of them is empty. So, and then there are the teachings of Buddha. No suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. Those are all Buddha's essential first turning of the wheel. And it says they too are empty. There's no this, no this, no this. And all that's left is prajnaparamita, which the bodhisattva depends on because there's nothing else to depend on. And if the bodhisattva depends on prajna, then the mind is no hindrance. It doesn't say the mind goes away or everything goes blank or everybody's happy ever after. It just says that the mind doesn't get in the way anymore. And that's what the Heart Sutra calls nirvana. So, and enlightenment. So that's the essence of it. But there's a lot to know, and it's basic Buddha teaching. So I'll try not to make it too tedious. Okay?
Have you seen that Red Pine has a commentary?
Yes, yes. Red Pine has a book out on the Heart Sutra, so that might be very helpful. The Dalai Lama has a book out on it. Thich Nhat Hanh. There are lots and lots of material on it. So it might be interesting to just look around a bit. And of course, different teachers have a different take on it, too. And Coben had his own take on it. So,
Are you suggesting that that might be actually the way we might want to study at this time, that everybody goes and gets their own version and brings it, and, you know, you obviously are going to be talking about it and have your own sources, but or should we have everybody the same?
Well, what do you think?
Probably easier if we do it, everybody get either what they have or what they can get, and that kind of mixes it up a little bit, especially One thing I've really noticed that I think is fascinating is the translations, and there are certain words in the sutra that are key, and even those sometimes can be translated very differently.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see, well, what are they, how could they have interpreted it that way? And that would lead maybe to a twist in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
If you open it. So that might be a rather good thing to liven it up a little.
I think you're right. You did that with one.
The Dhammapada.
The Dhammapada, that's what it was. Yes, and that was interesting. Yeah. Well, words, it's so hopeless, the words that we use, because they're just noises, you know, and we're trying to point to something, when it's this untalkaboutable experience of our life. It's really hard, and if it's coming through several different other languages and through 1,000 years or so, it makes it even more challenging to bring it all into our language. And of course, our languages. I found a book at Felsentor about Sandokai, which was in German. So when you think of it that way, it's coming into the West, but it's all over the world. And there's many, many different ways of calling it up and pointing to what it is. So the main thing is to study it with a sitting practice very strongly in place, because it's the experience of sitting that all those words are pointing to. What comes through us and to us and in us as Zazen is what those sutras are all about. What Buddha means. So that should be... Does everybody agree? Is that all right with you?
I'm quiet. I don't think I've ever done it in this group.
Okay. How about you, Britt?
I'd like to.
Good. Okay. And you too? I don't know whether you are ready to commit yet, but good. Okay. You, Julian?
Yes, sounds good to me.
Okay. Russ?
Yes.
I'll make it juicy. How was last week? What was that for you all? Did Donna Lynn give the talk?
Mm-hmm.
She did.
About Donna.
About Donna. Oh, that's the very first paramita. It's a very important, it's a wonderful subject.
Yeah, we had to pay her to get off the
Oh. I see.
Russ had the best story, though.
Oh?
You may want to share.
Well, everybody else heard, but I started a new job, and I'm working for a gentleman of Indian heritage. And what this gentleman does is that he invited me to go to a park, St. James Park in San Jose, downtown San Jose. And what he does, a group of people, they make vegetarian burritos, and they make about 60 of them at a time, and they go to the park, and they just hand them out to people that want it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's just interesting. I've never done this before, but he invited me to go with him and a number of times, and that's what he does. And it's just interesting that he says that people just, you know, normally will just take what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And they go to different parks across San Jose and do that.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's Dana Paramita. Yeah. Without getting paid for it, without getting praise for it, or any of those things, just doing it. Yeah. It's wonderful.
So there must not only be him and his group, but there must be other people that do such things out there that in the community that you don't see or hear about. They do it on the low, but it makes a big impact, especially for the people that, you know, are very needy.
Yes. And of course, anybody can do it. Any one of us. I have a friend, when she crosses the bridges, always pays for the car behind her. She doesn't know who they are, but she just gives extra money. And then, you know, usually they honk their horn and wave as she drives away. But we can do it in any kind of different way. It's so interesting to me because I can feel the change, the chemical change that goes on in the body when we begin to give rather than take. It changes the state of mind. There's this kind of freedom that comes with it. It's a kind of letting go that you can feel in your nervous system. It's very cool, really. And it's the first bodhisattva practice, the very first one, so that without it, you know, the patience and the vigor and the meditation and the wisdom aren't informed by that freedom.
Years ago, you told us some stories about Kobin and his charities.
He was endlessly charitable, insanely charitable, I would say. We were talking about him in New Mexico. He had a bunch of people building a house for him, and he took everybody out to dinner about twice a week to the fanciest restaurant in town. So he ran out of money and never finished his house. But they all had a wonderful time. He was like that. He just...
When things like that happen, did he express any kind of, like, regret? Or, you know... Like,
no. No, he just waited to see what was going to happen next. The house still is there. Such as it is, it's really not habitable at all. And when he came on hard times, he just accepted that too. There was a time when he lived out there when the house was being built. His wife had left him, and he was really, really hurt by that, and had moved out to New Mexico and set himself up with a little fire and a grate and a little tent and just slept out in the woods until the snow got so bad that he had to come inside. He did a little kind of hermit thing for a long time. And people would come and join him for a cup of tea. And every now and then somebody would bring him food. But he was fine that way also. You know, so it... He just accepted how things happened, whether it was so-called good or so-called difficult.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean when my reaction to that in my head is, wait a second, in Silicon Valley, and this is my frame of reference, you can't live your life without a place to live, a car, insurance, an address so you can, you know, pay your bills. Think of a thousand things that are at the edge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you But think about it. You couldn't even have a car if you didn't have a place where you could get a bill to pay your bill. You can't have, you can't live in Silicon Valley without a bank account. It can't be done. You can't live. I'm talking about
you can't live like a middle class person, but you can live. But I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean.
Even be I'm saying that you, it, like I've heard. I recently had a friend who got into some trouble. He's a lower middle class person. He turned off his phone. He had a phone. He turned it off. I feel like I can't communicate with the guy. I've got to send him email, which now he reads only when he goes to somewhere where he can connect his machine
to the library or something.
And he's not, and he's not poor. He's not poor, but it's like I realized what that. I began figuring out where that line was when this person took away that one thing. I don't call him that often, but it's an assumption on my part. It's an assumption on my part for me too. You know, you can take away a lot of things, but in Silicon Valley, I don't think it's that easy, and I think we've become accustomed to that. It's really interesting.
Well, it's. My former husband grew up in the war in Holland, and he talks about the enormous deprivation that happened where people were driven to eat mushrooms, you know, horrible little mushrooms from the forest. That's all there was to eat. And what a tremendous amount of compassion and care people had for each other. That instead of whining and complaining and, you know, bitching about your neighbor and all that stuff, that there was none of that anymore. That people all just held together because they were under such duress. The SS officers were everywhere, living in their house, actually, in his family's house. It was scary. But people helped each other out. And instead of feeling more alienated, they felt completely more cohesive. So I think that's what happens to us when we come on hard times. We more easily find each other. So it's not all bad. And in a way, I think we're kind of living in a dream world here. No, that it's pretty cushy. It's getting less cushy for a lot of us, and that's not a bad thing. Well, this says 9 o'clock, but I think it's 8 o'clock. I'm still back in Taos.